You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 282 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Trial of the Amazons number 1, Nubia and the Amazons number 6, Justice League versus the Legion of Superheroes number 2, The Joker number 13, Naomi season 2 number 1, Batman Urban Legends number 13, I Am Batman number 7, Batgirls number 4, Superman Son of Kal-El number 9, Detective Comics 1056, The Flash season 8 episode 7 Lockdown, Superman and Lois, Season 2, Episode 8, Into Oblivion, and Naomi, Season 1, Episode 8, Fellowship of the Disc. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news. Gotham Knights cast Supernatural star Misha Collins as Two-Face.
Well, good for him for getting work, Drew. I just can't picture reality in which this show is good, Drew. I would very much like to be proven wrong, and I will admit as much if it's true, but it just does not seem like a high possibility to me.
I know, we've talked about this quite a few times already. But they're still casting.
Yeah. Like I said, hey, good for the actor. You know, got to get that work in now that Supernatural is done, so I don't begrudge him in the slightest. Get that paycheck.
Up next for DC News, Tim Gabriel joins Season 3 of DC's Stargirl as Todd Rice Obsidian, the son of Green Lantern Alan Scott. No surprise there, because we knew he was supposed to be coming on to the show.
Yeah. I agree. No surprise. I honestly, Drew, I mean, I said this on the podcast, I thought we were going to see him by the end of last season. So exciting that we're getting him, but certainly not a shocker.
All right, up next for DC News. The CW has renewed 7 of its 19 scripted original series, including the Arrowverse shows The Flash and Superman and Lois.
Now, what's interesting about this is that they only announced 7 of the 19. And we know that CW generally renews almost all of their shows. Kind of interesting, Drew. I would imagine it's going to ultimately be higher than the 7 that they announced so far, but it is interesting that it's only 7. And there are some major DC ones on there that are not on that list.
And I don't know if that has to do with the CW being up for sale or anything like that, but it is interesting. All right, and for our last bit of DC news, Comixology says they're rolling out updates following angry user feedback. No surprise there, because what we got right now is pretty crappy.
I can't imagine not updating it. Like, that would just be negligent on their own part. Like, that's a great way to just permanently lose business. So I'm not going to compliment them for it. I mean, it shouldn't be like this in the first place, but I mean, at least they're, you know, realizing that they have a mangled mess of a e-reader right now.
That they do. I know.
Like
I said,
they do not deserve credit for fixing something that they shouldn't have released broken, but at least they are doing something.
Yes. I don't know if it'll be anywhere near what it was, but
hey, anything is, but it's just every week, Drew. I don't think I fully appreciated how many full page spreads that we read every week, because I swear we get them and you just get these tiny little mini micro pages and you're like, what am I supposed to do with this?
Pull out your magnifying glass.
Well, and the thing that bothers me is obviously you can click and they like zoom in on each part so you're sort of still reading it effectively panel by panel. But the thing is that they're big spreads. You're meant to read spreads as a whole. I know technically you are going bit by bit as you go through, but like those pages are laid out that way for a reason. You're meant to take in the whole picture.
Totally agree. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
It was the dawn of another podcast. The Epsilon 3 is a dream given form. It's a home away from home for three guys to watch a 90s sci-fi classic TV show. Three guys with microphones over 3,249 miles apart, all alone in the night. The year is 2021. The name of the station is Babylon 5. The name of the podcast is the Epsilon 3. Veer, bring me a drink.
We have 30 seconds to describe Thunder Talk.
We got big interviews.
Super red music.
We're proud members of the ESO Network.
Yeah, they're probably going to fire us.
I wouldn't blame them.
We've got jokes.
Adult jokes.
And nerd junk.
Woke nerd junk.
All the woke nerd junk.
Find Thunder Talk on the internet.
And the ESO Network.
Ta-da!
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comics book talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Trial of the Amazons number one. Queen Nubia meets with Hippolyta in private. Hippolyta tells Nubia she has made the right decision in making Nubia queen. Even now, upon her return, Hippolyta believes that Nubia should keep the crown. The future of Themyscira is in her hands. At the Amazon embassy in Boston Harbor, the Bana Migdol are asked to surrender their weapons before entering the portal to Themyscira. Queen Farika refuses and her sisters present arms. Queen Faruka states there is no Amazon law that would require them to disarm themselves before entering their homeland. Queen Faruka and Queen Atalantia meet with Queen Nubia and Hippolyta. Queen Faruka lets Queen Nubia know her feelings on how Themyscira has been guarding Doom's doorway. The Bana Migdol are there to enter the contest. Queen Faruka is none too pleased when Yara Flor and the Esquisita arrive. Io is currently guarding Doom's doorway. Queen Nubia brings Rhea of the Bana Migdol and Yorima of the Esquisita to join her at the doorway until the contest is settled. Queen Nubia addresses the Amazons about the contest when Queen Faruka interrupts and states the contest shouldn't be for Doom's doorway, but for the right to rule all the Amazons. Queen Nubia finds Hippolyta dead and a cup of wine spilled.
One thing that was interesting, Drew, from Antiope was, I think it was Antiope, right? Seemed to know that Hippolyta knew something was coming, or sense that Hippolyta knew something was coming. So it's kind of interesting to see what we get from that. There seemed to be an implication that Hippolyta knew she was going to die. So that'll be an interesting twist to potentially explore. Pretty interesting premise for a story, Drew, and I like it. I like the way it involves, obviously, the three different tribes that they've been developing in the last year or so. But the thing I really like about it so far, Drew, is that it is truly a Wonder Woman event, and it's not forcing other books to kind of kowtow to what they're doing. You know, I mean, I like the fact that it's a true, you know, Amazonian story. It's an Amazonian story, but also, Flash, whatever you're doing has got to be about Wonder Woman, too.
What I found interesting, well, we talked about this several weeks ago, I believe, about Hippolyta had mentioned something. She had said something about not dying. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, kind of foreshadowing, because we were both like, well, does that mean she's going to be dying? And it was no surprise to me at the end of the issue that she was the one that was dying, because we had talked about, we were surprised Hippolyta wasn't killed off before when Nubia became queen, because really, you know, with her handing everything over to Nubia, it'd be easier to just get rid of her. And obviously that's what they were planning on all along.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we assumed at the time that she was probably going to die in the whatever the Justice League story is, but obviously this is more interesting to do it this way, and, you know, makes the stakes seem more relevant to a Wonder Woman story. One thing, Drew, I have to ask that I'm a little, I guess, unclear on how it works is the whole Well of Souls thing. Like, I felt like what we kind of learned from that almost implied that they could potentially bring her back if they wanted to. And it seemed like that was just kind of not being brought up. And I'm not sure if I maybe just don't understand how it works.
From what I understand about the Well of Souls, from what we read recently, is it brings in women from man's world. It resurrects them somehow and brings them to Themyscira. And I guess they become Amazons from it or something. It seemed like it was random. And I never saw where it was mentioned that an Amazon would come back through it that way. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's how I understand it.
That's fair. Like I said, my understanding of it is nebulous at best. So I just kept sort of thinking of that, and I was like, I feel like this should be in play at least somehow, right? Well, it wasn't. I was like, okay, I don't really get it, but okay.
I thought about Hippolyta's death, and would they bring her back at some point? I was thinking about it. There's no real reason why they would need to bring her back with Nubia being queen now.
I agree, Drew, but you know at some point somebody's going to want to do like a quote purist reset of Wonder Woman, and it'll happen then. But I agree with you. There's no real reason for it to happen right now. To be honest with you, there's no real reason for Alfred to come back either on that. Like, obviously going off on a tangent, but there's no real reason for some of these characters to come back. But you know, in both cases, at some point they will, because somebody will decide that they'd rather have their version of that story back.
Yeah, and I would expect Alfred to come back before Hippolyta.
Oh, that's
just
fair.
because he's more embedded in as Batman's confidant than in Wonder Woman. I know she is an important character in Wonder Woman, but when you have the stories where Wonder Woman can't come back to the island, she's less important than a character like Alfred.
The other thought that I wanted to talk about with this issue, Drew, is I thought initially I wasn't crazy about how they were doing the Queen Faruka character, because she just felt like comically belligerent. You know what I mean? Like just over the top antagonistic to everybody for no reason. And I was like, I don't really like this. But then I kind of thought about how they often portray Artemis, and I was like, oh, you know, not that dissimilar.
Yes, that's very true. That could be where she gets it from.
To be fair, I generally don't like stories where Artemis is that, like, willfully belligerent either. So my taste is consistent in that regard. I was reading it, and I was like, look, I get that she's going to be, more eager for a fight because that's what her tribe is like and all of this, but, like, she didn't have, like, 1% of diplomacy, Drew. Like, it was just a complete zero in that category.
Very true. All right, well, let's move on to our next title. Nubia and the Amazons, number 6. The Temple of Persephone. Days later, Hippolyta is honored and then laid to rest in the palace. Nubia meets with the Amazonian leadership to determine if they should proceed with the contest or postpone it democratically. It is determined that the contest will proceed. Cassie asks Queen Nubia if she can speak. Cassie doesn't believe that Hippolyta's murderer entered the contest. Cassie wants to investigate Hippolyta's murder. Queen Nubia announces that one representative from each tribe will enter the contest. 2 days' time will be given to figure out who that will be. The Bana Migdal and some of the Themyscirans get into an argument when an arrow almost hits Andromeda. Caressi threatens to kill one of the Bana Migdal with her bare hands. One of the other Themyscirans tells Caressi to snap out of it and says it's like she blacked out. Queen Nubia talks to Medusa about how she was able to leave Doom's doorway. A sinister voice calling itself Aperion offered Medusa a chance to escape. Diana meets with Queen Nubia, stating she can't wait a second longer to get answers to her mother's murder. Diana intends to use the Lasso of Truth to get answers now. To be continued in Wonder Woman 785. And I gotta say, Cletus, because when I was reading part one, I was surprised Wonder Woman hadn't said anything about her mother's murder then. We waited to the end of this issue before she even said anything about it. I'm surprised she waited so long. I figured she would be wanting to investigate it right away.
The other thing, Drew, that I found a little... So there were two things that I wanted to mention with this issue. One, I thought the pacing of this was a lot different from the first issue. I felt like the first issue covered a lot. And then this issue was very simple, I thought, comparatively in terms of plot. Like, it was sort of just, like, quick to the point, like, it's just the funeral and the aftermath, and that was it. I don't know. The pacing felt much different than the first part of this story. And then secondly, I mean, of course you used the Lasso of Truth, Drew. How is that, like, the third thing they think of?
I know.
It's like, what? I was so miffed by the end of that, Drew. I was like, how are we just now getting to that? Why is that even like a... It's also, I felt like the comic portrayed that as if that was a controversial suggestion. And I was like, but why? Why would that be controversial? That's the most logical thing to do. Line everybody up, have them touch the lasso. You'll be done in an hour.
So, yeah, I mean... I'm glad they brought it up. I was surprised Diana didn't say anything sooner. The other thing I wanted to bring up was, and I added it into my notes on purpose, when Caressi threatens that one Bana Migdal Amazon, it seemed like they were pointing out that there was something up or something wrong with her.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if we're going to see that, or are they trying to foreshadow maybe she's behind Hippolyta's murder? Maybe she was possessed by somebody from behind Doom's doorway or something like that, like we saw Medusa do recently. I was just curious about that.
Yeah, no, Drew, I think you're right. I do wonder, you do have to feel like Medusa's potentially involved in this, right?
Yeah, I wondered that, but I thought about it, I'm like, that's too easy. If I was writing this, that'd be too easy of an answer to come to. I'd want it to be a little more mysterious than it being Medusa. Because that should be one of the first people you would jump to first. And then again, you know, we saw Medusa do something, control somebody before. But it's possible that it was something else that was controlling Medusa also. So I'm wondering if it's that maybe. But Medusa herself, I was just thinking, that's too easy of an answer.
It probably is, but I mean, we're definitely going to go down that road whether she did it or not.
Yeah, and I'm totally expecting somebody to accuse her probably in the next issue.
Honestly, much like you said, it's surprising how long it took to get to Wonder Woman trying to figure out the murder. It's surprising that it's taken more than two issues for somebody to accuse Medusa.
Yeah, honestly, you would think somebody would accuse her right away. So, but yeah, I don't know about you. I was happy we had part one and part two right together, because I'm into this crossover. I'm liking it a lot right now. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Justice League versus the Legion of Superheroes number 2. In the past, Kala Lur is greeted by Gedon, who represents some elders who believe the time is right for lanterns to be reintroduced to the galaxy. Kala, though born without visual sight, rescued children from a fire. On Oa, Kala Lur is given the first gold ring to represent a new kind of lantern. In the present, Kala Lur is alone at the Hall of Justice. All the other heroes disappeared, and Kala's ring had lost connection with the main lantern through space and time. The ring's functions are limited, and Kala's ring picks up an anomaly. In the 31st century, the Justice League are waking up to find out they are in the future. Naomi is called Queen Naomi by Dawnstar. Oliver meets Chameleon Boy, and Wonder Woman is fascinated by the future and how far humankind has come. Batman is grateful to see the future, but tells the Legion it's urgent that the Justice League return to the 21st century. The Great Darkness shows up again. Black Adam and Ultra Boy lead a team to go investigate. We see Black Adam shoots a lightning bolt through the darkness. Gold Lantern contacts Brainiac. Gold Lantern states he was hovering in front of a patch of blackness and a lightning bolt just shot over his head. Brainiac tells everyone to stop because there is a rupture in the space-time continuum. When Batman asks what that means, Brainiac answers, "The end of all things. To be continued."
This was certainly by no means a bad comic, Drew, but I also found myself wondering what we accomplished with this issue.
Not much.
The Gold Lantern story was cool, don't get me wrong, but I kind of wish I had just gotten a full issue of that, because that was interesting. And to be completely honest with you, it felt like that's really what Bendis wanted to write about. This whole thing feels like he wants to do, it's just an excuse for him to continue his Legion run that got canceled for understandable reasons, to be polite. And it's sort of just like, that's sort of what this issue felt like, Drew. It felt like a continuation of what he was doing with Legion, which was just essentially introducing us to each Legionnaire. I swear if he had been given carte blanche to have a run as long as he wanted, it would have been like 100 straight issues of introductions. And then like issue 101, he'd be like, all right, now everybody's here. We can finally tell a story.
I have to agree with you. It felt like he wants to tell a story about the Golden Lantern. Honestly, why don't you just do a miniseries about it?
I don't think he wants to do a miniseries about it, Drew. I think he just wants to set the table and set the ground rules for what that character is. A lot of his work, Drew, especially Legion, but with some of the other ones, like Naomi actually has a level of effort to it, but a lot of these things that he's doing, Drew, the villains that he's introduced in Justice League and Naomi and Superman, just kind of feels like he's just like lobbing characters at the wall and seeing which one sticks so that he can cash some of that sweet, sweet royalty money when they get adapted later.
Wouldn't be surprised about that.
But that's really what it feels like, and that's what this issue kind of felt like to me. I don't think, Drew, to be completely honest with you, that he wants to do a Gold Lantern miniseries to me. It felt like he wanted to do an issue of the Gold Lantern so that he can be like, hey, this is what the Gold Lantern is. This is his story. Now pay me when you adapt him.
One thing I'm glad about, because this title has been called Justice League versus the Legion of Superheroes, I'm glad they're not fighting each other, because I honestly didn't really want to see that.
Yet. there's a 0% chance they don't fight each other at some point, Drew.
But they've been working together this whole time so far. It'd just be awkward.
I agree. It's still going to happen. I'm not saying it's going to be the climax necessarily, but it will happen.
Yeah, right. I know you're right, but I want it to be right. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, The Joker number 13. The Samson clan has gathered for a feast, and Clown is on the menu for tonight. Lady Bane shows up on the Samson's land and sets fire to half the oil wells. Buddy attacks her, and she knocks his head clean off. The Samsons retreat to their safe room. Lady Bane goes after the Joker. Lady Bane tells Joker that she has been programmed to kill him. She is vengeance of all the people the Joker has wronged. She is the vengeance of Jim Gordon. Right when Lady Bane is about to super punch the Joker, Bane grabs her wrist. Bane tells Lady Bane, "Hello, daughter, it's time we spoke." And Jim Gordon is with Bane. To be concluded. I gotta say, I was pretty grossed out with all that stuff they were eating.
You know, the thing that kind of bothered me with that, Drew, is that it felt like that was the point, right? Was to gross you out. But, like, at the cost of it making sense to eat. Like, they were serving a plate of whole hands. I mean, not to get pedantic about this, Drew, but, like, what are you going to eat off of that? They don't eat bones. They're still people. You know, like, I know this is a stupid thing to kind of nitpick, but, like, it was kind of, like you said, the whole thing, they're just drawing all of these body parts to kind of gross you out and be like, ew, look, see, they're cannibals. They eat a plate of eyeballs. But I was like, most of that stuff that they were serving, Drew, wouldn't, again, I know this is ridiculous, but if you were eating people, that's not how you would serve that.
I agree with you. And it did gross me out. I was like, I just wanted to flip past that part.
I understand how ridiculous that sentence is, but nonetheless, I had that thought as I was reading it. I was like, this is just stupid. Like, I mean, like, if you watch any of the Hannibal Lecter films or the show Hannibal, like, again, I understand that those are also fiction, but they at least portray it in a way that you're like, yeah, that makes sense that that's how that would happen. If it were to happen, that's how it would happen. I don't know. It's another thing with this book, Drew, where I'm just like, are we really, I feel like our level of attention to detail is just not there.
I'm just glad this book's almost over.
I know. Well, and then we talked about this in issue one, Drew, and we knew exactly how we were ultimately going to feel about this book. And it's not really helped me not feel that, because I'm sitting here and I'm like, I despise, Drew, when writers paint themselves into a corner where they either have to actually follow through on the consequences that they set up for a character, or they just magic them away regardless of the logic that it makes sense. I hate when they do that. And they put themselves unnecessarily, Drew, into a situation where, frankly, the only logical thing that can happen is that the Joker dies in this story. I'm sorry. They've set it up in a way that it just, frankly, does not make sense for him not to die in this. And instead, they're bending over backwards to create any ridiculous plot loop that they can so that he walks away at the end of the story. Now, again, I understand that he's going to walk away at the end of the story. I understand that you're not going to kill the Joker. That's fine. Then just don't do the story. Or if you're going to do it, don't do it in a way that the only way you can get out of him not dying is to completely check logic at the door.
And logic's been checked. We also had a punchline backup, of course, with every issue so far. We had the trial of Alexis K. A Blackgate guard testifies that Alexa was a model inmate, even staying in her cell during the Orca riot. The guard also tells a story of how Orca attacked Alexis. Punchline takes the stand and has a statement that basically says she did nothing wrong, and it was the Joker that killed. If Punchline is convicted, then that sets a precedence for other victims of the Joker to be convicted. Cullen Rowe takes the stand and asks if his sister is the unidentified woman who attacked Alexis in the video. Cullen answers no, it's not her. And then Cullen goes on to explain that the Royal Flush Gang asked him to lie on the stand for Punchline. Then we see the jury finds Alexis K. not guilty. How surprising.
I mean, once again, Drew, literally the exact same criticism I have for the Joker story. If the only way that you can weasel your character out of consequences is by bending logic, then don't write the story, or write it in a different way that doesn't require that. It just, what was the point of the twist in this where, it shouldn't even be a twist, where Bluebird's brother has been just inconceivably stupid this whole story, and then all of a sudden, Drew, in between issues, he magically grows a brain
I'm sorry, but it's the truth. The first time he displays a shred of intelligence, this entire story, and actually tells what really happened, and then the story is like, yeah, but she still got out within 40 minutes. She's innocent. I'm like, what is the point of this story? What are we doing? Like, this is the thing, Drew. This story is obviously meant to continue to build the punchline character up and to really cement her right into DC so that Tinian can cash those sweet royalty checks somewhere down the line. But all I feel personally, and obviously my judgment is being clouded by my intense dislike of this character, but I feel like this story is only accomplishing people strongly disliking this character.
Yeah, I'm strongly disliking this character.
Like, you know what I mean? It's not the same as, like, you're reading a Joker story or a Two-Face story or a Riddler story where, like, they're doing something reprehensible and they somehow get away with it at the end. You're like, oh, well, that's kind of – you don't really like that. But this – I mean, it's like the crux of the story is her – this whole story has been centered around the injustice of her getting away with this. And I'm like, that's how you want people to grow to appreciate this character? I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I don't understand. It feels like the story is almost intentionally structured for you to hate her, which I guess in one sense you're getting a visceral reaction to a character. Maybe that's what you want. But, like, I'm just thinking outside of the fictional world, right? And in the publishing part, I don't know that that's the best strategy, maybe, to get your character to stick around long term, make everybody despise her.
Yeah, that's not a good long term plan.
Maybe it is. I don't know. I mean, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe it is a good plan. But to me, it's not the one I would take, I guess.
This character is either going to go away or somebody is going to – another writer is going to do something interesting with her and she's going to stick around.
Option three, we get another Joker's daughter type character that pops up once every 15 years or so in a story where you're like, oh, yeah, that character exists. And then you're immediately like, oh, yeah, and that's why they don't really do anything with this character.
Yeah, that's possible, too. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Naomi Season 2, Number 1. Naomi is in therapy and sums up what has been going on in her life and how she's now part of the Justice League. Things with her parents are different now, especially her dad who wants to train her to control her powers. Naomi tells Dee she has a plan. Naomi wants to go back to her homeworld and kick off Zumbato's head. Dee tells Naomi that he promised her dad that he would train her. When Dee doesn't show up for dinner, Naomi goes searching for him. Naomi finds Dee's bedroom trashed. Naomi suspects Dee has been kidnapped. Naomi's father shows up at Dee's place armed with an alien weapon. Mr. McDuffie tells Naomi to go home. Naomi says, why? What did you do? To be continued. Okay, Cletus, I read this issue, right? To me, it felt like her dad did like a 180 all of a sudden and is acting totally strange.
The dad is definitely not being portrayed the same. This could be wrong, Drew. I don't feel like he's being drawn the same either. I feel like his look was different in this issue, but that might be wrong.
I don't remember, honestly.
I feel like her dad was a little more like dad bod and was kind of schlubby in the original. And this one felt like they were drawing him a little, not a lot. I'm not saying that he was their absurd version of D in the comic level of buff or anything, but as I was reading, I immediately was like, wow, the dad looks different to me. And then, like you said, he was acting way different. And I was just like, okay, all right.
Yeah, it definitely felt like, are we making the dad the villain all of a sudden? It just felt weird to me.
I don't think so. I think what they're trying to do is to tap into that teenage angst thing where they feel like their parents are against them. And then it turns out, you know, the typical, it's not actually them. I don't know. I don't think the dad's the villain. I could be wrong though.
Yeah. It just felt weird. And it's weird reading the comic And you got, like, Zumbato's definitely the villain in this, but not in the TV show. It's weird, too.
It's bizarre, Drew, because I really thought the comic was pretty good, and it was clearly, so clearly made to be adapted, and it's just baffling how wildly different they've chosen to make it. Like, it's not just they've made certain decisions because a CW budget is, like, three pennies. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just that they can't afford to adapt certain things. They're, like, making significant story changes that you can't just attribute to budget.
Yeah. Totally agree with you. All right. Well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman, Urban Legends number 13. First story, we have Batman and Zatanna in Bound to Our Will, part 3 of 6. John Constantine helps uncover the truth that something came through when Zatanna and Bruce originally did their spell. And when they tried to fix it, something else came through. Both beings are feeding off their energy. Batman, Zatanna, and Constantine fight back against these magical beings, and they seem to be getting the upper hand until Constantine gets hurt. The old woman tells the boy to quit playing with his food.
Drew, the story at the very beginning of this comic was heartbreaking, where you see how great that character's parents were, and then they die tragically, and then he continues to live up to, like, their legacy, so to speak, by being a great person himself, and then he just gets killed. I was just like, why would you do that? You didn't need to traumatize us at the beginning of this story.
The story in this issue, it felt a little dragged out. It felt like we spent a lot of time with Constantine trying to figure out what was going on, and then we got a little bit of action at the end.
Yeah, yes and no. I will agree it was a little bit slow in the middle, but I do think it did also, I feel like it covered a lot of ground in kind of establishing a lot better who these villains are. Obviously we don't know exactly still, but we have a better feel for that. We got to explore the weird love triangle going on between the three main characters. I don't know. I mean, I'll give you that it was a little slow, but if we were doing this as a normal 6-part story, we'd inevitably have scenes like this anyway. It just seems a little odd because it's packed in with a bunch of other short stories.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Up next, we had White Witch in Stigma, part 3 of 3. Rhea remembers a ghost she once loved. And one day she'll remember enough that she will kill Simon Saint.
Drew, I have to wonder if she was supposed to have been the one that killed Simon Saint in a different draft of the Batman plan overall, because this story was a little bit unsatisfying in how it ended, because we know that that's not how he dies. If you change that one thing, because we know Simon Saint is dead, and we know that she's not the one that did it, I feel like it kind of brings the end of that story down a little, because she kind of figures herself out, right? She's like, she realizes who she is. She kind of pulls her identity together in a sense and makes that promise. And all of that is awesome, Drew, except we know how it ends. And I was sort of like, oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. All right, next story we had was Eternity and Eternity in Gotham, part 3 of 3. Chris is searching for Regina while the ghost of Hannah tags along. Chris tells Hannah the story of how he died along with his dad after being shot. Chris woke up in the morgue with no wounds. Using his abilities on Hannah, Chris learns the murderer is Creasy. Rhea shows back up and states Creasy did not kill Hannah. Instead, Rhea explained she and Kate killed Hannah. Kate has been trying to take over the living for a while. And then a strange man shows up, takes Rhea, and tells Chris to stay away from the dead. That ending was weird. I don't know if I was supposed to remember that guy from before or something, or why he just...
I wasn't sure initially, Drew. I don't think this is the case. But my initial reaction was it was supposed to be like a version of the Spectre. And then I was like, well, that doesn't totally make sense. I don't really know. I did not really like the ending,
because I was like, wait, I felt like the story just got interesting there. And they're like, the end. I was like, wait, whoa. Hey, we've actually finally made this interesting now. What are we doing?
It also felt like they're setting up some story in the future.
Yeah, I imagine it's going to be another short story in this book, which I think is probably the best decision because I don't know that there's enough there to support its own. I hope they do follow through on it.
I found the character interesting and some of the stuff that was going on interesting, but I got to say, the ending just wasn't that good.
No, they're withholding of some information until the end, and then it was just sort of like, wait, all the interesting stuff you like hid until the end. What are we doing? There were some nuggets in here we could have explored.
Totally agree. And then the last story we had was Ace the Bat Hound and Hounded, part 3 of 6. Ace and the rest of the animals escaped last issue. Lex Luthor is helping the bad guys track down the animals. The bad guys want the animals found because the pet cemetery is full of human dead bodies, not animals. Mr. Tarkov wants to see who is behind Batman's mask. When Mr. Tarkov's lackey tries to remove Batman's mask, its defenses kick in. Mr. Tarkov tells his daughter a story about a lion and a puppy, and when the daughter asks the point of the story, Mr. Tarkov states that sometimes stories don't have a point. Sometimes stories exist merely to catalog our suffering, and as a reminder, life rarely gives us puppies. And then the story ends with the bad guys finding Ace and his new friends.
Ooh, what a downer of a speech at the end there, Drew.
We got that story, and it felt like that was Russell's point with this story, that sometimes stories exist merely to catalog our suffering.
I mean, honestly, if any writer was going to make a point like that, I'm not shocked that it's him, because as funny as he is, and the thing I love about this Ace story, Drew, is that that wit is still there, right? Like, there are a lot of, like, sly, clever jokes that are in it, like Lex Luthor, right? And yet, it's still a very dour story. So, I'm not shocked that it came from him, but, man, I'll be honest, I don't have high hopes for a happy ending for this story.
I know what you mean. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. I Am Batman #7. Commissioner Beckett is at a press conference, and questions are being asked about the murder of Devlin Rubel, as well as the Special Crimes Unit being dubbed as Strike Force Bat. Detective Chubb wants Batman to go after Rubel's killer, but Batman wants to go after gray market dealers who are dumping guns to fuel a gang war. Innocent people are getting caught in the crossfire. Whitaker states that he, Chubb, and the unit can take out the gun runners, but what happened to Rubel is beyond them and needs Batman on the case. Detective Chubb is not happy about being called Strike Force Bat. She is also not happy with who has been assigned to the task force. We have Mike Tanaka, who's been involved in 4 officer-involved shootings in the last 3 years. Chubb counts that as trigger-happy in her book. Then there's also Michonne Mueller, who's had numerous HR complaints filed against her. Whitaker states that Chubb should know better than to judge people just because of the way she was bounced out of Gotham. Tanya Fox meets with Mayor Villanova about the Fox Family Impact Fund. Tanya wants the fund to be used to help people with medical needs like her daughter, not to build opera houses or flower gardens. Batman hunts down Rubel's head of security, Tyrone Burrows, and Batman discovers that Burrows ran because he had signed a non-disclosure agreement and couldn't go public with what he knew. All he could do was run. Vol tells Jace that Rubel was into some messed up stuff, starting with trafficking of minors for sex. Vol states it was all uploaded just a few hours ago, but cross-referencing bank accounts and travel records, it seems legit. Rubel had the whole city fooled. Vol was able to track the upload to an abandoned building. Batman checks it out and discovers some messed up paintings of mutilated bodies and parts. A guy in a mask appears and tells Batman, "It's cool. I'm just here to help you. Oh, what do you say we make something beautiful?"
Drew, I feel like this book is really starting to come into its own with the move to New York. I feel like the writer is more comfortable with the setting and dealing less with Batman's world, because I really do feel like there is a level of disdain for the Batman world, if I'm being honest, that continues to bleed through his stuff, which is fine. But I think it's helped the book to move out of Gotham, because then I think it lets him like think about that less and dwell on that less and kind of focus on his own story. And I like what we got in this, Drew. This was really interesting stuff. We see Batman trying to focus on taking down low-level crime, because that's what people are always overlooking, and that's what he felt like Batman was overlooking. And then you see the kind of the deal made with the police, and like it's a completely logical deal, Drew. Like that, both sides win, right? They need the help. That is, like they said, it's above them. They can't handle, you know, a murder at that level, but they can handle the gun, you know, the gun trafficking. So let them do that. Let him take on the murderer. It was great stuff, Drew. I really liked this issue a lot.
Yeah, I did too. And then, you know, once they traded cases and Batman started investigating what was actually going on, there was something deeper that he didn't know was going on. And yes, it does need his attention. And then he's all in at that point. And then we got introduced to his own first own villain, which that guy's a creep.
I have to say, I was not crazy about the look that they had for the villain, but I'll wait to reserve judgment until we get more out of him.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batgirls number 4. Babs is tired of spending the last 6 hours rebuilding the firewall after Seer got in. Cassie and Stephanie go to the local bookstore, which is owned by Mr. D. Mr. Green comes in and buys some books that have been impossible to find. Stephanie follows Mr. Green when he leaves because she still thinks he's possibly the serial killer. While Stephanie is watching Mr. Green's, Charles Dante runs into her, the guy last issue from the art show that Barbara once dated. Stephanie and Cass both think the guy is weird. Stephanie states there is no way that he saw Steph at the art show because her and Cass were batgirling. The Batgirls are heading to stop the Tutor. The Saints spot them and track them. When the Batgirls find Tutor, he uses his gas against them. Stephanie comes under Tutor's control again. Tutor orders Stephanie to fight Cassie. Cassie is able to break Steph out of her trance, and Stephanie kicks Tutor's ass. Oracle arranges for the Batgirls to drop off Tutor at Charles Dante's office. After the Batgirls drop off Tutor, we learn that Charles Dante is really Spellbinder. Have we seen the Spellbinder character before?
I don't know.
I didn't remember him from anything, so.
I guess, Drew, sometimes, to be clear, I continue to enjoy this comic, but I do find it frustrating sometimes where a comic introduces a character that is clearly a villain, right? Like, when we meet that guy, they're like, hey, huge flashing red sign, this dude's a villain, and then they have the characters play into whatever the villain scheme is. Like, Barbara conveniently decides that, inexplicably, the person they should drop this major villain off to is some dude? I don't care if he's a psychologist or not, Drew. That's not where that guy gets taken to.
Yes, and she's a policeman's daughter. I have to agree with you on that, Cletus, because I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, really? A policeman's daughter would know better than that.
So I was not crazy about that. But otherwise, I continue to love the style of the comic. Some of the writing is really funny. I was not crazy about that. I like the twist, in a sense, that this guy that supposedly, you know, is a positive member of society is a villain. Sure, that's fine, whatever. But maybe don't have the heroes just willfully hand over a villain to him.
Yeah, totally agree with you on that. And reading through this, I understand this isn't geared for us, but I still enjoyed it too, so. I can overlook some of the silly stuff in this issue. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Superman, Son of Kal-El, number 9. 3 nights ago, a former Titan named Risk was killed in Metropolis. On the same night, 2 other superheroes were found murdered. To be safe, Oracle instructed every hero not to work alone. One hero kept working alone, according to news outlet The Truth, Nightwing. 3 superpowered beings show up, calling themselves the Rising. They plan on murdering Nightwing. They toss Nightwing off the side of a building. Nightwing falls smugly with his hands behind his head as he watches Superman John Kent fly by him. The Rising are angry to see Superman because the Gamorrean satellite tracked him leaving the United States an hour ago. The Earth is round, so Superman kept flying around until he came back. One of the Rising tried to butt-head Superman. It doesn't go well for him. The other 2 retreat back to LexCorp. Back at Gomorrah, President Bendix is furious. He orders the termination of the Rising member that Superman has captured, and the bomb in his head explodes. Back at the Kent farm, Dick tells Lois he recently invested in the Truth. Dick asks Lois to work for the Truth as a reporter. Dick brings John some tea, stating that Alfred believed tea was the cure for everything. It's not medically accurate, it's just British. Dick offers John some comforting words and advice, stuff he has experienced and learned over the years. Jay shows up at John's house because someone exploded in John's arms, and Gamora has released satellite footage saying John killed him. Lois decides she is joining the Truth to reveal the truth.
I don't have a ton to say about this issue, Drew. It's just very enjoyable, and I just absolutely love his portrayal of Nightwing. I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Yes, it is. My favorite scene in this was when they threw Nightwing off the building, and then the next scene you see him with his hands behind his head, like he's in a relaxed position, just falling. Freaking loved it. And then Superman coming by him and then going, we tracked you leaving the country. The world's round. I just went in a circle. I freaking loved it. I really like this issue a lot. I thought there was a lot of funny stuff like that in it. And
I agree, funny, and also some heartwarming moments. The talk between Grayson and John, just really good stuff. He just gets Dick Grayson so well, and his portrayal of John is nice too, you know, not ditching him on a planet for 5 years is a bold step, so.
So yes, I really like Tom Taylor's portrayal of both Nightwing and John Kent, and I've been enjoying both the titles he's been writing, and I love the fact he did a crossover. That's the thing I liked about this crossover is you didn't have 2 different writers trying to do the crossover. It's the same writer doing the crossover, and you know the story just flows well together. I really enjoyed it. All right, let's move on to our last title for this week, Detective Comics 1056. The mayor's wife is talking to Psycho Pirate, and we find out how messed up she really is. Psycho Pirate tells her there is no cure. His powers can make people happy and compliant, and it was only temporary until they collected money from the city. Scarecrow has taken over Arkham Tower. Scarecrow wants everyone in the tower to be brought to him. Huntress is battling Mr. Freeze. When Huntress has stopped Freeze, she decides to get the security systems down and then find Nightwing. Scarecrow's goons find Dr. Meridian. Harley Quinn shows up and kicks their asses. And apparently Harley Quinn was undercover pretending she was an inmate who thought she was Harley Quinn. And she frees Dr. Meridian. Harley Quinn takes down Arkham's security system. The rest of the Bat family is able to get into the tower. When the Scarecrow goons get to sub-basement A, the Tim Drake Robin shows up. Scarecrow calls Mayor Nakano and taunts him. Scarecrow throws Nightwing out of a window. Hey, that's the second time this week, huh? Our Batwoman tries to catch him and fails. Batman shows up and catches Nightwing. The mayor's wife asks Psycho Pirate how this ends. Psycho Pirate replies that he doesn't know. An avulsion appears with a gun stating, "It doesn't, Psycho Pirate. Don't you know? There is no end now, and it's just getting started." Anna fires the gun, but we don't know if she killed the mayor's wife or Psycho Pirate.
I mean, you gotta assume it's Psycho Pirate. But I don't know what, to be honest with you, Drew, I don't know what killing the mayor's wife accomplishes.
When I saw that, I was like, she had to have killed the mayor's wife because Psycho Pirates in the big crossover.
That's a good point, Drew, but I don't know. I'm not talking from like a character motivation standpoint. I'm talking from a writing standpoint. What does killing the mayor's wife do?
It doesn't. Like,
what does that accomplish? That's just an unnecessary death. Also, I got to be honest with you, Drew. I totally 100% believe that the stress that her life has gone through in the last year or so has become a little too much for her to handle. That made complete and total sense to me. However, the reaction to that is to go to Arkham? What? She just needs a therapist, Drew. I don't understand. I didn't understand. I was just like, I read that and I was like, do you understand how therapy works?
Somebody deals with
trauma and they have to go to a psych ward? Come on, man.
The only reason I would think she had gone there is because they were having this miracle cure. And
yeah, that's fair, Drew, but they were portraying it like her and her husband were reacting like this was the only thing that could possibly help her. Like, she literally just needed a therapist. Harley Quinn could have sat down with her, Drew.
Yeah, I agree with you, Clayton, but I'm just pointing out that's probably why she was there. They were looking for a miracle cure. I don't know. I read it through, and then I reread it when I did my notes, and this issue didn't feel like it flowed that well, I didn't think.
No, it's a mess. This story's been a mess. It's one of those things, there are some legitimately good ideas in this, Drew. It, in my opinion, has not been pieced together very well. It's just very sloppy.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. We also had the House of Arkham Part 10. The boy and his gang and Killer Croc steal food back from the Penguin. Food that was intended for all people of Gotham. The boy takes the food to Dr. Leslie Tompkins and her patients. Leslie is less than thrilled Killer Croc is there. One of Leslie's helpers tells the boy she knows where to find more food. And the boy meets up with Helena Bertinelli in Poison Ivy's garden. Helena tells the boy about Black Mask's abandoned warehouse with food. When the boy gets to the warehouse, it's a trap set by Batman and Huntress. Batman plans to put an end to the boy's gang. The boy states they are not a gang, but the helpless and forgotten of Gotham. They were just wanting food and medicine. Batman says he made a mistake. He tells the boy to take what they need and he won't get in the way. But when No Man's Land is over, you're done doing this.
I've made a point that I've suspected that this guy might be that Nero character. I'm less certain of that now, Drew. This made me doubt my take. The other thing, I don't know about you, Drew. I found it odd. The beard felt odd because they were still drawing him young, but he was growing a pretty healthy beard.
Yeah, that was weird. The other thing I thought was weird was the Batman sting operation. I thought that felt weird too.
I mean, yeah, it did feel weird because it felt like he had done zero research on somebody that he should. Drew, he's dealing with Leslie Tompkins. The boy's dealing with Leslie Tompkins. How is that not on Bruce's radar?
Yeah, exactly. It just didn't make sense.
I continue to be interested in this story because I'm mostly just kind of morbidly curious how they can screw this poor kid's life up next. I do feel like Batman has been uncharacteristically sloppy throughout this story, though. Like, I mean, like, truly, truly dropping the ball at every possible turn. He's not made one correct decision yet.
Yeah, and I doubt if he will. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
And I'm Tony Heath.
And we're the hosts of the Watchathon of Rassilon,
a podcast where we're watching through all of Doctor Who.
And we're just about finished with the classic series.
Depending on when you hear this, we may already be done.
So why not go check for yourself?
And while you're there, why not go ahead and listen to every single episode of the Watchathon of Rassilon?
And watch as Joe loses his last little tenuous grip on sanity.
The Watchathon of Rassilon, a proud member of the ESO Network.
At the 42 Cast, we want to bring you everything, and that's why we've jam-packed the next few months with as much as we can. You not only get the same reviews, topics, and interviews that you did before, you also get screen reads, where we compare a movie to its source material, or role models, where we talk about tabletop gaming. It's never been a more exciting time to check out our show. It's your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything, so why not check it out? We can be found on most podcasting platforms, and we are a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back. Let's talk The Flash, Season 8, Episode 7, Lockdown. Captain Kramer wants a direct line to The Flash where they can work more closely together instead of The Flash just dropping off criminals and the CCPD trying to figure out what crime was committed and making it stick. Kramer, Barry, and other officers fall unconscious when the CCPD is gassed by Goldface and his gang. When the officers wake up, they're all wearing meta-dampening bracelets that are rigged to explode if the wearer tries to remove him. Goldface wants some rare and valuable items from the CCPD armory, namely the bullets that can take away metahuman powers. Goldface has a buyer for them. Barry tells Goldface he can make a device to track the dark matter in the bullets. Instead, Barry creates a sonic device that allows him and Kramer to escape. Kramer's metahuman powers are too erratic for the bracelet to handle, and thus her bracelet deactivates. Barry discovers the real reason Kramer wants to get in contact with the Flash is because she needs someone to train her to control her powers. Kramer distracts Goldface by using his own powers against him, while Barry is able to remove his bracelet. The Flash shows up and stops Goldface and his gang. The Flash and Captain Kramer form an alliance to work together. Flash reveals his identity to Kramer, but she had already figured it out. We also get some dating drama this episode between Caitlin and Frost when they end up going on a double date. Caitlin reveals her real feelings for Chilblain, and Chilblain has a talk with Caitlin, and Caitlin realizes that she is taking out her own insecurities about dating on Chilblain. We also had some awkward scenes with Chester and Allegra. The episode ends with Joe and Iris having dinner. Joe goes to the other room to check on the baby. Iris experiences a change in the timeline when Joe walks in from the garage bringing Iris a file on some murder.
Drew, this was a fine episode. I don't think it was great by any means. But I also feel like this is kind of where we're at with The Flash in that, what was the point of the episode ultimately? What did we accomplish? I just feel like the show just sort of exists. Like, it's just like, hey, FYI, if you tune in, you'll see The Flash. And that's just sort of it. Is that best case scenario for the show now? It's just like, it happens, I guess.
I thought this episode was a little better than some of them we'd been seeing, minus the all the drama stuff. I thought the team up with Flash and Kramer was, it accomplished setting up their newfound friendship, their new Batman and Commissioner Gordon alliance, if you will.
Yeah, but did we need a whole episode to do that? I agree with you, Drew. I did not think this was a bad episode necessarily, but I just sort of, as I was watching it, I was like, what are we doing exactly? Like, if we're just going to be an episodic show, it felt a little bit like, I know that we just did the little mini series to start this season, but even that felt fairly episodic to me, Drew. And I feel like this show continues to, I know we had some rough go at attempts at a serialized story, but it feels like their solution to their failures to tell season or even half season long stories is to just not do that at all now.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it's going episodic. I have to agree with you on that. But we still have the overarching story of changes to the timeline going on. We have that. I thought
that is such a loose overall thread so far, though. I agree with you, but that is loose.
Yeah, it is loose. But I still find it kind of interesting.
It's just a shame to me, Drew, that, like, I find it frustrating that this is a better episode of the show. That's frustrating to me.
Because
that's such a low bar.
It is. I mean, all you have to do is go back and rewatch season one. You can see how much of a nosedive the show's taken. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Superman and Lois, Season 2, Episode 8, Into Oblivion. John Henry is showing signs of brain trauma when he thinks Lois is his Lois. Natalie asks the doctor to give him another brain scan. Lois convinces Principal Balcom to let John take classes online. John is going to be working at Britt and Dunn's convenience store starting today. Allie Alston has Anderson go through the awakening. Anderson says the Bizarro Alley is ready for the ascension. Chrissy gets a once-in-a-lifetime exclusive with Allie. A van comes and picks her up. Chrissy hands over her phone, and in the back of the van are two people in hazmat suits. While talking to Sarah, Jordan Superhearing picks up Jonathan's girlfriend arguing with her ex-kryptonite supplier. Allie takes her followers into the mine so they can merge with their other selves. Quite a few people get sucked through the portal before Superman is able to save them. Anderson takes ex-kryptonite, grabs the pendant from Allie, and goes through the portal by himself. Chrissy was not sure if Lucy was sucked into the portal because everyone was wearing hazmat suits. After work, John walks Candace to her friend's house. Mickey Jorix shows up wanting his money. Jordan hears John's in trouble and goes to help. Mickey gets the crap beat out of him by Jordan. Lois and Sam are talking at the farmhouse when Lucy shows up. Lucy explains she kept hearing Lois's warning in her head and had to get out of the mines. Everyone was wearing hazmat suits, so nobody saw Lucy leave. They had taken Lucy's phone, so she had to walk until a lady picked her up. Sam tells Lucy she doesn't have to worry about Allie because she is locked up at the DOD. Sam takes Lucy home. Lucy drugs his tea and takes his DOD card because she was the failsafe to make sure that Allie makes it to the other side. And I gotta tell you, Cletus, they got me. They got me because when Lucy came back, I was like, oh, okay. And then she tells her story. I'm like, oh, okay. This is all good. And then they got me at the end.
I can't say that I had the same. I will say, I'm not gonna sit here and tell you that I knew that she was going to drug her dad when she got home. But I was awfully suspicious that she had just miraculously seen the light. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not saying I predicted anything that happened. I just wasn't shocked that she was still on Allie's side.
I should have suspected something.
This was totally fine episode, Drew. I really liked, actually, the B story with the brothers kind of helping each other out and standing up for each other. That was good stuff. I still find myself unfairly, maybe, but like, I'm disappointed, frustrated. That instead of Bizarro, we've settled on Allie and this essentially nameless general. I know he has a name, but you know what I mean? Like, it's a nobody. It's very frustrating to me, Drew, that's who we've settled on being antagonistic for this season and not freaking Bizarro.
Yeah, it is strange. Next episode's the season finale.
That's bananas. This is the thing. Like, I would agree. I know you mentioned this last podcast, Drew, that it seems like they might bleed into next season with this story. And I would say if this was not the CW, that would be likely. I feel like if it does bleed into next season, it's going to bleed into episode one. And then they're going to awkwardly cut it short halfway through the episode and then just do the rest of the season after that.
That's possible. We'll see. We'll see, though. It may just wrap up next episode. because, you know, I'm thinking about it. What else are they going to do? I could see them ending the story next episode, too.
I hope they do. It's going to feel, there's no way it doesn't feel abrupt. They've done almost nothing with that other world. That is, it is criminally underdeveloped at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Naomi, Season 1, Episode 8, Fellowship of the Disc. Naomi and her friends are playing miniature golf when Naomi's super hearing kicks in. When leaving for school, Naomi overhears her parents talking about moving to keep Naomi safe. Annabelle is not thrilled that Naomi is actually considered moving to keep her friends safe. Zumbado thinks Naomi should be training with her powers, not a bow staff. Dee states using her powers could draw attention to her enemies. Zumbado states they already have her enemies' attention. When Naomi comes home after training, she tells Annabelle that she hears someone in the house. Naomi discovers someone has been in her bedroom and stole the disc. Zumbado wants a meeting with Naomi. When they meet, he wants her to train to use her powers, specifically with learning how to fly. Naomi goes to Star Labs and starts searching around. Jacob shows up. He is also looking for alien tech. Naomi finds a hard drive that seems to be intact. When a beam almost falls on Jacob, Naomi catches it with her super strength. Naomi and Jacob combine Jacob and Dr. Bell's technology to create an alien tracker. Naomi and Jacob track an alien to a storage unit. When they get there, Naomi discovers her stuff from when she was a child. She also discovers a to-go pack with fake IDs and cash. Commander Steele sends a team into the abandoned Star Labs building and confiscates everything. Jacob fine-tunes his alien detector and discovers there's an alien at her parents' anniversary party.
All right, Drew, I want to get into my weekly "This Show Is Ridiculous" nitpick.
Is it the mini? Is it mini golf?
Yes.
Because that's mine, too.
Drew, my God, it cannot possibly be that hard to film a mini golf scene. Like, they have the boyfriend swing like a full golf swing inexplicably, and obviously rockets the ball into the water. The thing that doesn't make sense with that is that they never, for whatever reason, I genuinely don't understand this, Drew. They don't ever show the full, like, hole that they're on, right? Like, I don't need you to set up an entire mini golf course, but, like, surely you can construct one, right? Like, that cannot possibly be that hard to budget. But they never show the full thing, and he inexplicably rockets it. I understand if you've never played mini golf before, you might not hit the ball well, but you're not going to golf swing it. And then, and I'm sure you had the problem with this, both girls putt the ball in from like 2 inches away and then celebrate like they've never made a putt in their life before.
I know. I found that whole scene ridiculous. And then they're doing all this instructing like they're the greatest miniature golf players ever.
The thing was, is there was the potential for it to be funny, Drew. Like the whole thing where Naomi and her friend are like discussing the wind and all of that. That's fine. That's funny banter. But then they cut and it's a light tap in, and that can be part of the joke. To be clear, you can make that part of the joke. Like, it's ironic that they're analyzing all of these like different things for just a tiny tap in, but it's not. That is unironically not a part of the joke. It's just there.
I had a feeling you were gonna rant about mini golf because I was like, really, really?
It's just true. It's just, again, it's this attention, this lack of attention to detail. It could not possibly have been that hard to do that scene accurately. You know what I mean? I know it's a silly thing to complain about, but I feel the reason that I mention stuff like this is because it just reinforces this idea that the show just does not care to pay attention. It just doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with you on that. The other thing I thought was stupid was the D. Zumbado arguing about how to train Naomi. I mean, I get where Dee's coming from. She shouldn't be using her powers too much. But she's still got to train to learn how to use her powers. She's going to be using them at some point. And, you know, I think Zumbado was a little over the top about it. And Dee was just being unreasonable about it. I just thought it was ridiculous. It took them that long to figure out they both needed a trainer.
I'm glad you brought that up, Drew, because my girlfriend, who barely watches the show, right? She's usually like in the kitchen or in the living room or something, because she has understandably no interest in the show. But she came home during one of the Zumbado scenes, and she was like, "Don't you find it kind of weird and creepy that these grown men keep arguing about what to do with Naomi? And it's sort of not up to her. It's sort of up to what these men want to do." And I was like, "Oh, you know, that's a really good point." Drew, I mean, let's be honest. That's a great point. That's what it's a little bit weird, right?
Yeah, that is weird that you think about it.
You would think, and especially you would think a show on the CW that is targeted primarily at young adult and women, they would maybe be a little more cognizant of that.
Now, they can't even figure out a mini golf game.
But it's just sort of coming across that way.
Yeah. I know that that's not their intention, but you're right. It is coming across that way. Of course, we're talking about a show that can't figure out mini golf either.
Right. Well, yeah. Can't disagree there.
Anything else you want to say about Naomi? Are we ready to wrap this thing up?
I am ready to wrap that season up.
We are in the last part of the season, so the funny thing is we got Naomi that's honestly she's not ready to be a hero yet. It seems like they're really slow burning her becoming
this
hero.
It's too slow. I mean, let's be honest, it's far too slow.
Of course, we've complained about other shows doing it way too quick. This show's doing it way too slow.
Yeah. And you could say that we're being hypocritical, but I really don't think we are. This is clearly too slow paced. I mean, I don't think we're going to see her with her costume, Drew. It's a pretty good costume. I feel like that's some, let's be honest, it's the sort of thing that gets eyeballs on a show, and they're just not doing it.
Yeah. Totally agree with you. All right. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah. So obviously it was not the most talked about thing that came out of last night, to say the least. But I did have to mention the Flash running into the Speed Force winning most cheered moment on the Oscars last night, Drew, was a hilarious achievement by the internet. When you look at the other scenes that they had it going against, it's inexplicable that it's even on that list. And the fact that the internet came together in that moment to vote that DC moment as the most cheerworthy film moment is awe-inspiring.
All right. And for my shout-out, we just recorded another episode of Earth Station DCU Classic. And this time, Kevin and I go back to the year 1989. So you can check that out on the ESO Network Patreon. If you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman, Superman, World's Finest number one, Batman, The Knight, Blue and Gold, Titans United, Wonder Woman, Evolution, Catwoman, Justice League, Nightwing, The Flash, Wonder Woman, Detective Comics, and of course our DC television shows, The Flash, Naomi, and the season finale of Superman and Lois. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.